Good morning. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the July 10th, 2013 edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners, which just happens to be the case on the 31st of this month. In June, Forthright Radio's Joy LeClaire and I exchanged the last two Wednesdays, so it's been 3 weeks since I shared time with you, and a newsworthy 3 weeks it has been. Arguably, the most important and controversial has been a rerun of the 2011 protest in Cairo's Tahrir Square. The first ones 2 years ago in January led to the downfall of Egypt's longtime dictator Hosni Mubarak. Then just last week, even larger protest rallies in Tahrir Square against his replacement, the Muslim Brotherhood's Mohamed Morsi, Egypt's first democratically elected president, resulted in him being removed from office by the country's all-powerful military. In short, the crowds in Tahrir Square, on whose backs Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood rode to power, turned around and rode him and them out of it. Any way you look at it, it was a coup, and although once supported by at least 22 million Egyptians who had signed a petition calling for Morsi to step down. As a result, the events in Egypt have led to more differences of opinion across the entire political spectrum than is a civil war in Syria or any other conflict in my memory. Not only are the mainstream media pundits and many of the politicians who once condemned the Muslim Brotherhood and Morsi now defending him because he was quote-unquote democratically elected, but so are a number of left observers who were fearful of the power of Egypt's army. That Morsi was behaving autocratically and ignoring the will of a larger population, including those not in the Muslim Brotherhood who had voted for him, was clear. A substantial segment of the Egyptian people had simply decided not to allow the bait-and-switch act to continue, and the army took advantage of the situation to bring it to a close. Unlike this nation of sheep that makes hardly a peep as one president after another launches attacks on countries and peoples who have never harmed us, one that spends billions of tax dollars on weapons about which the public has no say and doesn't even know or seem to care about, and that has set up a surveillance system over our private lives that we're not supposed to know or care about. Under the circumstances, I would say any complaint about the failure of democracy in Egypt from these quarters falls flat on its face. In this country, let's face it, it just provides a facade for the corporations to do what they want to do because our politicians, both at the beginning and at the end of the day, are their servants, not ours. It's, after all, the nature of capitalism. Today, at about 20 minutes past the hour, we'll be taking a look at the regime change in Egypt with Professor Juan Cole of the University of Michigan, who has lived and worked in the Middle East and has an unusual take on the Muslim Brotherhood and Morsi. He has compared them to the Tea Party and Michelle Bachmann, so stay tuned for that. In the interim, let's look at what else has been going on over the past 3 weeks, about which I feel the need to give you my take. Let's start with President Obama. It's been quite a time for the president, who went from a G8 meeting in Ireland to Berlin for another speech at the Brandenburg Gate, managing to leave just ahead of revelations, courtesy of Edward Snowden, that the massive surveillance operations of the NSA did not stop at the shores of the Atlantic, but extended to the capitals and government offices of virtually all of America's longtime non-English-speaking allies. While most of the attention of the U.S. media has been focused on Snowden's whereabouts and his efforts to find asylum out of Washington's clutches, the European media is more concerned with his revelations. Only one hand-picked group of nations is excluded, noted the German Weekly Spiegel. Countries that the NSA has defined as close friends or second party, as one internal document indicates. They include the U.K., Australia, Canada, and New Zealand. A document classified as top secret states that, quote, the NSA does not target its second-party partners, nor request that second parties do anything as inherently illegal for NSA to do, end quote. For all of the countries it goes on, including the group of around 30 nations that are considered to be third-party partners, however, Spiegel continues, this protection does not apply. A review of the headlines in Spiegel's July 1st online issue gives a good idea of how the Germans reacted to the news. With a cover portrait of Edward Snowden and a sinister visage of Obama in the background above the headline, Allein gegen Amerika, literally Alone Against America, how the NSA targets Germany and Europe was not only the leading article, the overall subject took up a major part of the magazine. Merkel "Infuriated by U.S. spying" was the headline of another. It described how German Chancellor Angela Merkel compared U.S. spying to Cold War tactics and how Brussels wants EU facilities checked for American eavesdropping equipment. Spiegel noted that the NSA is more active in Germany than in any other country in the EU, with some 500 million communication connections being monitored every month. Under the headline, "Friends or Foes," another article says, "Berlin must protect Germans from U.S. spying." In the same vein, another article reports that, quote, "the German Federal Prosecutor's Office is looking into allegations that a U.S. intelligence agency has conducted massive spying against German citizens. A first formal complaint has already been lodged in one city, Gießen," according to the magazine. A spokeswoman of the German Federal Prosecutor's Office, which is responsible for domestic security issues, told Spiegel that all available and relevant information about PRISM, Tempora, and Boundless informant spying programs is currently being reviewed by the agency. The Tempora program was apparently run by the British in collaboration with Washington. According to the content of documents reviewed by Spiegel, spying by the American NSA has been far more widespread than previously believed. That these revelations may have an effect on the results of the upcoming talks between the U.S. and the EU over a transatlantic free trade agreement was discussed in another article titled "EU Official Questions Trade Negotiations." According to Spiegel, senior European officials are outraged by revelations that the U.S. spied on EU representations in Washington and New York. Some have called for suspension of talks on the transatlantic free trade agreement, end quote. Well, you know, that hasn't happened, of course, and the talks in Washington have begun on schedule. But we doubt if President Obama will be taking a trip to Germany very soon. Just days before in Berlin, he had underscored the vital importance of the transatlantic alliance, the deep and enduring bonds between the U.S. and Germany, and the values that bind us with Europe. And what was the White House reaction after the exposure of the NSA spying operations on his alliance partners? Obama tried to make light of the situation when it caught up with him in Africa. "Every intelligence agency in the world does it, including the Europeans, so there is nothing unusual about Washington spying on its allies," said Obama in Tanzania. He claimed that every intelligence service tried to get as much information about what was going on elsewhere, including in Europe, that went on beyond what they read in newspapers or watched on TV. "If that weren't the case, then there'd be no use for an intelligence service," Obama told reporters. Of course, that's nonsense. No other country has more than 800 military bases in 63 countries and conducting low-intensity wars in at least four countries that they need to keep track of. Moreover, the heavy-handed efforts by Obama to put Snowden under lock and key by putting pressure on foreign governments to deny him asylum while at the same time dismissing him as some hacker have understandably made the president a laughingstock. Outside of the friendly media, the meeting of the G8 countries in Ireland was not a particularly successful event for the president, although he tried to put his best spin on it. The situation in Syria, as expected, had topped the G8 agenda. After having previously announced that the U.S. would begin supplying light arms to the Syrian opposition, Obama made little progress in pushing Russian President Vladimir Putin to drop his support for the Syrian government. This led to a final statement from the government leaders that endorsed a political solution to the violence, but stopped short of calling for President Bashar Assad to leave power. The crisis in Egypt has drawn attention away from the ongoing conflict in Syria, but it has not lessened its importance. One of our frequent guests, Patrick Coburn, writing in The Independent at the end of June, warned that, quote, "the foreign media reporting of the Syrian conflict is surely as inaccurate and misleading as anything we have seen since the start of the First World War. I can't think of any other war or crisis I have covered in which propagandists, biased or secondhand sources have been so readily accepted by journalists as providers of objective facts. A result of these distortions," observes Coburn, "is that politicians and casual newspaper or television viewers alike have never had a clear idea over the last 2 years of what is happening inside Syria. Worse, long-term plans are based on these misconceptions." He cites a report on Syria published in late June by the Brussels-based International Crisis Group that, quote, says, "once confident of swift victory, the opposition foreign allies shifted to a paradigm dangerously divorced from reality, end quote. Slogans replaced policies, writes Coburn. The rebels are pictured as white hats and the government supporters as black hats. Given more weapons, the opposition can supposedly win a decisive victory. Put it under enough military pressure, President Bashar al-Assad will agree to negotiations for which a precondition is capitulation by his side in the conflict. One of the many drawbacks of the demonizing rhetoric indulged by the incoming U.S. National Security Advisor Susan Rice and Britain's William Hague, he says, is that it rules out serious negotiations and compromise with the powers that be in Damascus. And since Assad controls most of Syria, Rice and Hague have devised a recipe for endless war while pretending humanitarian concern for the Syrian people, end quote. That's an excerpt from Patrick Coburn's excellent article from the June 30th Independent, which you can find online. Meanwhile, in Iraq, you do remember Iraq, I'm sure, even if most Americans have forgotten about it. It was over a week ago, the New York Times reported, that since April, at least 2,000 civilians had been killed in what appears to have been sectarian terrorist attacks. I say appears to be because, given the nature of the attacks, they can well have been launched by outside forces that have an interest in aggravating the country and the region's Sunni-Shia conflict. With car bombs and IEDs exploding daily throughout the country, the number of dead are continuing to grow in what appears to be another endless conflict brought to the peoples of that country and the world by that beacon of liberty, the United States. As we leave the Middle East wars, let's go back for a few moments, however, to the G8 summit in Ireland, where on June 21st, President Obama came under a scathing attack from a member of the Irish Parliament. Claire Daly, who represents North Dublin for the socialist Tak Da Dalwa Party, did not mince her words. Here's a short excerpt.
I think it's important to take this opportunity to bring a bit of balance into the discussions around the visit of the US President and his wife, given the almost unprecedented slobbering over them that the nation has been exposed to over the last number of days. And it's really hard to know which is worse, whether it's the outpourings of the Obamas themselves or the sycophantic fawning over them by sections of the media and the political establishment. We've had separate and special news bulletins by the state broadcaster to tell us what Michelle Obama and her daughters had for lunch in Dublin, but very little questioning of the fact that she was having lunch with Mr. Tax Exile himself. We had very little challenging of the fact that she's glad to be home. Home, a country that she's been in less than a week and that her husband has very tenuous links in. And of course, the biggest irony of all, the protestations of Obama himself in his speech to the children in Northern Ireland about peace. When he said, "Those who choose a path of peace, I promise you that the United States of America will support you every step of the way. We will be the wind at your back." Now I ask you, is this person going for the Hypocrite of the Century Award? Because we have to call things by their right names. And the reality is that by any serious examination, this man is a war criminal. He has just announced his decision to supply arms to the Syrian opposition, including the jihadists, fueling the destabilization of that region and continuing to undermine secularism and knockback conditions for women. This is the man who is in essence stalling the Geneva peace talks by trying to broker enhanced leverage for the Syrian opposition by giving them arms, and to hell with the thousands more who lose their lives or the tens of thousands more who will be displaced as this war goes on. This is the man who has facilitated a 200% increase in the use of drones, which have killed thousands of people, including hundreds of children. And you, Taoiseach, you are the one who's turned a blind eye on these activities. You've talked about the G8 being an opportunity to showcase Ireland. But is it not a reality that you have showcased us as a nation of pimps, prostituting ourselves in return for a pat on the head? To be honest with you, we were really speculating this morning whether you were going to deck the cabinet out in leprechaun hats decorated with a bit of stars and stripes to really mark abject humiliation here.
Claire Daly of the Tak Da Dalwa Party, representing North Dublin, Can you imagine a speech like that on the floor of Congress? Well, the Israelis have found a way to get rid of the refugees from war-torn sub-Saharan African countries who entered Israel illegally, believing that a country that never stops complaining to the rest of the world how it turned its back on Jewish refugees in the 30s would not only talk the talk, but would walk the walk. They were, of course, wrong. Fearful that the presence of black Africans would undermine the quote-unquote Jewish character of the state, and unhappy with the condemnation it has received for badly mistreating them, Israel has apparently made agreements with several African states to take the refugees, quote, in exchange for benefits package, including security, economic, and agricultural aid, as reported by the Israeli paper Yediot Ahronot. According to a senior official, the paper says, the security aid will include Israeli arms and military knowledge and training, end quote. This seems to be a win-win deal for Israel, allowing it to further penetrate sub-Saharan Africa while getting rid of what the Israelis consider to be, quote, a demographic threat. That other so-called demographic threat, the Palestinians show no signs of being so easily gotten rid of.